So let me just say, as we get back to the series that we started several weeks ago, this will probably come as a bit of a surprise to you, but as a teacher, I am sometimes subject to pranks of students. It's not earned, it's not appreciated, but at the same time, it's given. And I have to deal with that, and there's a few examples I could give. I'm not going to, because I don't want to inspire others to try to one-up the ones that have already been done. But I can tell you this, in all of the years that I have been a teacher, that I've suffered pranks at the hands of students, I've never dealt with anything like this. On a November evening in 2004, 44-year-old Victoria Ruvolo of New York was driving to her home on Long Island. She just attended her niece's recital and was ready for the couch, a warm fire, and relaxation. She doesn't remember seeing the silver Nissan approach from the east. She remembers nothing of the 18-year-old boy leaning out the window holding, of all things, a frozen turkey. He threw it at her windshield. The 20-pound bird crashed through the glass, bent her steering wheel inward, and shattered her face like a dinner plate on concrete. The violent prank left her grappling for life in an intensive care unit. She survived, but only after doctors wired her jaw, affixed one eye by synthetic film, and bolted titanium plates to her cranium. She will never go another day in her life without thinking about that evening, because she can't look in the mirror without a reminder of the pain that it brought. So I'm reading this story, and this is weird. I've never dealt with any kind of pain like she did, and yet at the same time, there was a parallel for me that I picked up on, a similarity, and that is that many of us, and myself included, we struggle to look at ourselves without a reminder of some pain that we've dealt with at some point in our lives. Sometimes that's physical pain. We have a scar from something, and when we look at it, we're reminded of that pain. And a lot of other times, it's emotional scars. Maybe we see someone else who did something to us at one point in time, and even though we don't want to think about it, our minds immediately go back to that. And when that happens, it prompts us to respond in a way that is completely contrary to what we're taught in Scripture. Remember, when we started all of this, I suggested to you that those who have encountered grace, something is different about them. They behave differently. They act differently. The world looks at them and says, that's not normal. And here's a prime example. If you've encountered grace, you will not respond in a way that you are tempted to. How will you respond? Well, here's what the Apostle Paul says. Be kind to each other, tenderhearted, forgiving one another. Just, hold on a second. Imagine being Victoria Ruvolo. Is it human nature to, when dealing with that 18-year-old that has shattered your life, to deal with that person in a tender-hearted, forgiving, kind way? That is not human nature. To forgive as though God, through Christ, has forgiven you. Not human. What is human nature? Human nature is retaliation. I'm assuming most of you know what a Dear John letter is. A Dear John letter is when you have a soldier, a dude who's off at war, and he gets a letter from his fiance, from his girlfriend, from his wife, who's informing him that she has found love in the arms of another man and she's moving on. That's a Dear John letter. They're horrible to get. This is maybe the best Dear John letter I've ever heard of, though, and I'll tell you why. This guy, this is a true story, he's in Afghanistan. He gets a letter from his fiance. It's a Dear John letter saying that she just couldn't do it. She couldn't go on. She didn't know if he was even going to come home and what he would be like when he came home, and she needed something more constant, and so she'd found someone else. And then the kicker of this letter is, I'm reading this story. She wrote in the letter that she would really like it if he would return the picture of her that she had given him to take, because it's her only copy of her favorite picture of herself. Now, that's a kick in the face, and especially because this guy said, I know what she wants. She wants the picture back so that she can give it to the other guy, or maybe use it for her engagement pictures to this other man. So he shares this letter with his brothers in arms, and these guys are foxhole buddies, so they care about each other, and they say, this is outrageous. We've got to come up with something. So what do? They all take a picture of their own wife or girlfriend that they had. They give it to this guy. He puts them all in a letter, sends them back to his former fiance with this note. Hey, please look through these, find your picture, and return the rest. Forgive me, but I honestly can't remember which one you were. That right there, That is human nature. That's exactly, and it, look, the way you're responding, it makes you feel good when people do this. They're giving somebody their comeuppance. It's exactly what they deserve, and we like that. It's what is human nature. Retaliation is appealing, and yet that's the way of the world. Jesus teaches us something completely different. If you got your Bible, open it up to John the 13th chapter. We'll do what we've done in the past. That's where I'll read the passage and then we'll go back and kind of pick it apart. John the 13th chapter. I know you know this story, many of you, but let's look at it in the context of grace. John 13, start in verse 1. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." "No," Peter said, "you shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." Then Lord Simon Peter replied, "Not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said not everyone was clean. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. That's what he says to his disciples, and it's what he says down through the ages to us. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. Do we do them? That's the question. I want you to start here. Look at verse 3 in that passage and notice what it's telling us. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. Jesus knew this and that he had come from God. What does Jesus know? John is very clear here that Jesus knows who he was. He is the Son of God. Nobody more powerful than him. He knows why he was here to serve God. He knows that he is returning to the Father. Jesus knew his identity and his authority. Let me say that again. Jesus isn't curious about himself. He knows who he is. He knows his identity, and he knows that no one possesses more authority than he does. So what does he do? Knowing his identity and his authority, how does he use that? There is no one more powerful or more authoritative than him, and how does he use that? So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Several weeks ago, when we were in the midst of the election season, what did I say? Look at the life of Jesus in a new way. Look at everything he does and tell me that he is not making an utter mockery of earthly power. Everything that we believe is powerful, Jesus is saying it's the total opposite of that. Here you have the master of the universe who spoke all things into existence, and he's on his knees washing the feet of his sinful disciples. Stop and pause and consider, is that something you'd see Caesar doing? Kneeling down and washing the feet of his servants in his palace? No, because that's not. And look at what Peter says to him in that passage. Peter objects and says, "You're not going to wash my feet. I mean, I should be washing your feet. You're not going to wash my feet." Well, why is Peter saying that? Because that's the earthly understanding of power. Powerful people don't do this. Someone with the identity and the authority of you, Jesus, should not be washing feet. An utter mockery of earthly power. Let me go on record as saying that I'm not one of the people that get really freaked out by feet. Some of you do. I mean, I'm not like into feet, but at the same time, I'm not freaked out by feet. My wife, for instance, she doesn't like feet. She thinks all feet are ugly, which just prompts me to, when she's asleep at night, sometimes I'll just whip it around and tap her, boop, 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 with the big toe, wake up, foot right there. It's her love language. Anyway, so, but I'm not as freaked out by feet as other people are, but I will acknowledge this to you. I think we can all, no matter where we stand on the issue of visible feet, I think we all can appreciate the fact that you do not go to work and find your coworkers that have pictures of their loved one's feet on their desk. If you do, you need to find a new job. Those are not people you should be surrounding yourself with. When you ask someone to show you pictures of their grandkids, they don't start cycling through a bunch of ankle down photos. Oh, look at him right here. This is the soccer game. See the ball off in the... You don't see that. And why? Because we appreciate the face. We don't appreciate the feet. And that is so true, particularly in Jesus's day. Today, we do all kinds of things for our feet. We house them in these little boxes, these little foot houses that we call shoes, and we protect them, and we have moisturizer for our feet. I use Jergens. I don't know what it is that you use, but anyway, we take care of our feet, and pedicures. People go and have all that stuff done to them, and so we take care of our feet. In this day, the feet was the workhorse. The feet is out there. They're carrying you where you need to go. You're wearing open-toed sandals if you're wearing anything. And so you get all of this horse dung and dirt and mud, and it's caked all over those feet. These are grimy, nasty little dudes. And here's the master of the universe that kneels down and wipes them off. Stunning. Knowing who he was, the Son of God, where he was going, the right hand of the Father, Jesus kneels down and he touches the dirtiest part of his disciples. He cleaned their filth and their ugliest parts about them. He lowered himself and wiped away their grime. This was the job of a servant or a slave. It's exactly why Peter objected to it. You shouldn't be doing this. And Jesus is setting an example, saying, of course I should be doing this. And I want you to notice in that passage, he washes the feet of all of them. It says when he gets done washing his disciples' feet, Jesus washes the feet of every single guy who is there. Who does that include? It includes that guy, Philip. Now, we don't know a lot about Philip, but we know enough. You know who Philip is? Every group of friends has this one. This is the question asker. Everybody else understands what's going on, but this is the one, and you're looking at each other because some of you are the question asker, and you ask incessant, absurd, ridiculous questions that don't need to be addressed. I have this with some students, none more so than my obnoxious sister. I had her in class in 2005. Never in my life have I dealt with a student that has asked more insane, ridiculous, unnecessary questions. Well, do you want us to dot our I's with a little circle like that, or do you want a dot, or do you want the T at an angle, or do you want the T crossed? Straight, just do it. You know the question askers. And that's Philip. Philip is the one of the disciples. When Jesus tells them to go out and feed the 5,000, the rest of them are like, all right, we'll give this a shot. What does Philip do? Philip needs an explanation from Jesus. Well, how's that even possible? Well, this is all we've got, and there's 5,000 people. You're going to need to walk me through this, Jesus. How is it possible we can do this? That's Philip. So you tell me, how does Jesus treat those who question his commands? He washes their feet. How do you boss, how do you treat your workers who question your commands, your authority? How do you're leading a group meeting, question, or how do you deal with those who question your authority? You're a parent, how do you deal with children that question your authority? You're a teacher, how do you deal with students that question your authority? Are you washing feet as a servant does? Have we encountered grace? Has it changed us? Remember when I led off and I said, has grace softened us? This is what I'm getting at. Not just Philip. Jesus also washed the feet of James and John. We know a little bit more about James and John because they're one of Jesus' inner three. They're like one of his three best friends on earth. And yet, what are these guys doing? These are the guys who, while Jesus is out there teaching humility, they're arguing with each other over who was greater. Who's going to get to sit at Jesus' right hand through all eternity? Jesus, tell him it's going to be me. Because you remember what he did a few weeks ago, right? With the fish. It should be me, shouldn't it? They're arguing about it. Tell him I'll sit at your right hand. How does Jesus treat those who would use his kingdom for their own pursuit of power? He washes their feet. How do you treat those who use you to try to advance themselves? They're thinking of themselves and using you in the process. Are you washing their feet? Have you encountered grace and been changed by it? He washes Peter's feet. I mean, you can take your pick with this guy. I love him, but take your pick. This is the guy who quit trusting Jesus in the storm and sinks out there, and Jesus has to pull him out. This is the guy who tried to talk Jesus out of the crucifixion. I mean, you sat there and read that, and you just want to tell the guy to shut up. I mean, this is your salvation. Jesus is working out, and Peter's like, I think there's a better way to do this, Jesus. I don't think you really need to the point that Jesus has to say, get behind me, Satan. You don't know what you're talking about. This is the guy who denies he even knows Jesus. So how does Jesus treat those who break their promises to him and their trust in him? He washes their feet. How do you treat those in your life who break their promises to you over and over, betray you in a way that tells you you can't trust them? Do you wash their feet? And of course, we know the other one. Look at this part of the passage. Jesus answered those, he answers Peter here, those who have had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is clean, and you are clean, though not every one of you. Who's he talking about? Well, he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said not everyone is clean. And remember what the beginning of the story, the passage says, that Judas had already done it. He'd already betrayed Jesus. So stop and consider this scene. Judas is sitting there in the room, acting like all of the others, acting like everything is fine. He's putting on a show, saying all the great things about Jesus, just talking him up to his face. And the whole time, Jesus knows what Judas has done, that Judas has betrayed him. This Judas, this lying, greedy man who's going to exchange Jesus for 30 pieces of silver, and to his face, he's still saying all of these nice things. And Jesus knows it. How does Jesus respond to one like that? He washes his feet. Stop and think. Jesus knows this guy just betrayed me, and he kneels down and washes his feet. Is that us? What does that mean about how we treat the Judases in our lives? I know this Judas walked away with 30 pieces of silver. I don't know what your Judas has walked away with. Maybe your Judas walked away with your kids in the divorce and fundamentally altered your relationship with them for the rest of your life. Maybe your Judas walked off with your virginity because he told you that you could trust him and you were going to be together forever, and he walked away with that. Maybe Judas walked off with your job, the one that belonged to you, and he stuck it to you and took it. Maybe your Judas walked off with your security, and now you live in a constant state of fear and anxiety because of what was done to you. Maybe your Judas walked off with your spouse. You trusted him, and they had an affair and took your spouse away. Maybe your Judas walked off with your innocence, that uncle that molested you when you were a child. I don't know what your Judas walked away with, but I know Judas does that. We are to wash his feet and let him go? Is that what we're really supposed to do? That's certainly not the way of the world. You just laughed at that story of the Dear John letter, telling me you're just like me. You enjoy the retaliation. It makes you feel good when somebody gets what's coming to them. The world is always ready to retaliate, and they celebrate those who are best at it. I love that story. I love the thought of that woman opening it up and getting that message. It just makes me feel good. That is the way of the world in me. You know that's the majority of the people that surround you. They're like a simmering pot of coffee, just ready to be cranked up and to explode everywhere. We say that all the time. Well, you better not cross them. Oh, you better not upset that person over there. That's the way we talk. But something has happened to us, right? Go back to the first week. That's the way the world is supposed to look at us. Something has happened to them. Grace has happened to them. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, Jesus says, have washed your feet, what excuse do you have? I'm the master of the universe and I washed your feet. Tell me what your excuse is. Tell me what someone has done to you that means you shouldn't wash their feet. I've set you an example that you should do as I have now done. Christians, when we accept the gift of grace, we're also pledging to allow Jesus into our hearts, which means what works out from us is going to be displays of grace to others. That's one of our greatest witnesses to the world. Many of us, if you're like me, and I think most of you are in this way, there could be 15 good things that happen to us, but what do we dwell on? The one bad thing. There could be a million good things and blessings that come into our lives, and yet in our minds we're constantly replaying the hurt that happened to us. We're constantly drudging it up in our minds. We keep a record of wrongs, or at least we keep a record of one wrong so that we can use it as leverage when the time comes. It's one of the things, when I'll do premarital counseling with couples, that I talk about this idea of forgiveness. It is so cheap these days to say, I forgive you. But you don't really forgive somebody if you're going to hold on to whatever it was and use it. And we do that with our spouse all the time. I know I'm guilty of it. If there's something that I can use later to get what I want, I'll bring it back up. Well, then I haven't really forgiven, have I? Forgiveness means that you're not going to make that person bear the weight of what they've done to you. They no longer have to suffer for what they did. You bear that weight yourself. That's grace. That's what we're supposed to do. But so often we try to use those events to rob others of the joy and the peace that we say they took from us. And in reality, we're just robbing it of ourselves, that peace. Why? Because when you harbor grudges, you will ensure that your life is utterly joyless. But I want them to know that what they did was wrong. Yeah, I get that. I understand that. But please remember that showing grace is not endorsing misdeeds. When you show grace to somebody, you're not affirming and saying that what was done was okay. When Jesus forgave us of our sins and goes to the cross, he is not endorsing all of those deeds as okay. That's not what grace means. Jesus doesn't endorse our sin when he forgives us, and you don't do the other. You don't do it to someone else. A person full of grace is still going to send a murderer to prison. And a person full of grace is still going to expect child support to be paid from an ex. This is my point. Grace is not blind. Grace sees injustice, but it chooses to see God's love more. That's the key of grace right here. What will grace do when it changes you? It will prevent hurt from poisoning your heart. Have we been changed by grace? Or are our hearts, at least in some way, still poisoned because of things that have happened to us? It's what the writer of Hebrews says. See to it that no one falls short of the grace of God. Why? So that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. If you are not changed by grace, that is the consequence. In other words, without grace, bitterness will grow. And for some of us, it's been growing for a long time. But with grace, when we're changed by grace, true forgiveness will grow. And that right there, that will set the world on its ear. They don't know what to do with that because it's not the way of the world. I want you to notice the sequence of events. So we're winding down here in John chapter 13. It's a very important sequence. Jesus washes, and then he hands the towel to us to do the same thing. He's not asking us to do anything that he himself has not done. He demonstrates the way, and then we follow in that way. His love washed away the dirt of your anger. It washed away the dirt of your dishonesty and the sludge of your adultery and pornography and the grime of your hypocrisy and your dysfunction. He wiped it away. All of it, all of those things hurt him deeply. But he chose to take them away. And then what? And then after doing that, he turns and hands you the towel and says, you need to do that for those who have hurt you as well. Have you been changed by grace? Or have you tried to accept grace while at the same time not letting it flow out from you? If you're doing that, then you haven't fully embraced what Christ has done. I want to tell you how Victoria Ruvolo's story ends that I started with earlier. 9 months after that fateful November night on her way home to Long Island, Victoria Ruvolo stood face to titanium-bolted face with her offender in court. Ryan Cushing was no longer the cocky, arrogant, turkey-tossing kid in the Nissan. He was a trembling, tearful, remorseful, and deeply apologetic young man. For many New Yorkers, he had come to be the living embodiment of America's youth, selfishly oblivious to the feelings of other people. The courtroom was packed that day with people anticipating Cushing getting his comeuppance. Story had been all over the newspapers. So when the judge announced his decision, shocking and enraging those gathered there, they were expecting something so much different. The judge ruled that Cushing would receive only 5 years probation and some court-required counseling and public service. The courtroom erupted with indignation to the point that the judge had to gavel them down and then explain to the angry people there that his light sentence was, as he put it, against his better judgment, but he was doing it as he was extending a courtesy to the victim, Victoria Ruvolo, who had requested the leniency from the court for the boy that had hurt her so badly. Following the judge's announcement, Victoria stood in the silent courtroom with arms open as Cushing walked over to her and she embraced him. She held him tightly and stroked his hair while he sobbed, and she said into his ear, "Ryan, I forgive you. I want your life to be the best it can be." Victoria later explained to the journalists there that her extension of grace was merely a reflection of the grace that had been extended to her by God. "God gave me a new life, and so I just chose to pass it on. If I hadn't let go of that anger, I feel I'd be consumed by this need for revenge. Forgiving him helps me move on." Fittingly, moving on for Victoria meant the formation of her life mission, working with the county probation department to help others find grace. Asked if it doesn't still sting when she's commonly referred to by inmates as the turkey lady, Victoria smiled as she walked out of the room. "Well, it could have been so much worse," she said with a smirk appearing at the corners of her reconfigured face. "He could have thrown a ham at me, and now I would have to be known as Miss Piggy." That right there is grace. What is that? That is someone who has suffered incredible hurt, but looked down and saw her newly washed feet by the Savior. Saw him extending the towel to her, saying, "Do the same." And she chose to do it. Have we? Father, I thank you for the gift of grace, something that we can't comprehend, but Father, we invite it into our lives and we ask that you give us the strength, the otherworldly strength that is so contrary to our human nature, to show it to others and to find in so doing that we're the ones who are blessed. Having heard these things, having seen these things, if we do them, we will be blessed.